Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I'm very pleased once again to be speaking, after a gap of just over a year, amazingly, to our good friend Dr. Tim Ball for the nth time, sixth time, seventh time, something like that. Dr. Ball is, as I always say, highly entertaining, yet always informative and challenging, which is a great combination of attributes for somebody involved in teaching, which is what Dr. Ball was and is, a teacher. He has lectured in geography and climatology at the University of Winnipeg, where he taught for about 25 years. He is also an environmentalist, public speaker, consultant, author, and columnist. And officially, he's retired. Whatever that means, he's retired. Tim, great to be speaking with you again.
Well, thank you. And I say that this retirement's killing me. I'm going to have to get a government job to get a rest.
Oh, well, thank you ever so much for coming on again. It's always great to speak to you. And I, as I said, it is unbelievable to me that it's been a whole year since we last spoke, but I checked and it is true. And the last time we spoke, we talked about educational ergonomics in January 2016. Very interesting conversation. If you've not heard that, people do go and listen to that because it was a very fascinating conversation. But I'm hoping that it won't be a gap of a year this time because we have so many things to talk about. This time around, that we're probably going to spread what we have to say over a couple of interviews. So today, I hope we're going to find time to talk about four smaller things, and then next time, whenever that might be, one big thing. Well, I'll wait to tell you what that one big thing might be. But today, these four smaller things, if we get through them, I'm going to list now. Dr. Ball, your court case with the climatologist Michael Mann, your recent experience of being involved with the Trump administration's transitional arrangements at the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency in the US, your views on this incessant claim in the media that last year was the hottest on record, which seems to appear, well, I'm going to say with almost farcical regularity, to be honest, and your views on the recent attempt to get rid of or perhaps reassess, depending on your views on the matter, what I always thought was the roughly 20-year pause in global warming. So we have those four things that I hope we're going to be able to get through. So the floor is yours, basically, Tim. Which one would you like to address first?
Well, I think that there's no chronologic sequence to them, so I'll just do them in the order in which you presented them.
Okay.
I have them on a sheet in front of me so that my failing memory won't fail, and I can tick them off as we go through. Okay.
I can hardly believe that. I've explained to you so many times before. Failing memory, I don't think so.
Well, you know, the old gray cells start to wear out after a while. In fact, it occurred to me the other day that we're living longer, but the parts are still wearing out at the same time. So somehow we've got to get that evolutionary gap sorted out.
But I have to say, there's no evidence as far as you're concerned.
Well, thank you.
As a good empiricist, you must surely accept that's the case.
Well, and that, by the way, that word empiricist is very, very important. It's sort of behind a lot of what's going on in my life right now. I was just in Australia with Senator Malcolm Roberts, where we challenged the bureaucrats of the Bureau of Meteorology in Australia to produce empirical evidence of human-caused global warming. And, of course, they can't do it. What people need to understand, and they'll lead from this into the court cases against me, all of the evidence and claims that are made are based upon computer model generated claims. And of course, they've written the computer models to produce the results that they want. And then in a classic circular argument say, well, the computer model says this, therefore it's true. This is a part of the deception, which I happen to think is the biggest deception in history, that human-caused global warming. It's not a hyperbole to say that, because the whole global warming issue has had a truly global impact. Every single country, every citizen is affected by it, energy and policies on a global basis. And of course, it's been such a deception that anybody that dared to challenge what they were saying immediately was isolated. Now, one of the reasons they were able to get away with this deception is because most people don't understand the science. And it's this exploitation of a lack of knowledge that is what allows people to get away with things.
But of course, what the climate science establishment would say is that people have been hoodwinked by what they call the, well, I hate the term, but they do tend to call the denialism industry, the skepticism industry, let's call it that. And so people are not able to think clearly about it because they're being given misinformation. Now, I'm not saying that I agree with that, but that's the line that's often taken, isn't it?
Well, there's a couple of things about that. One, of course, is that this use of terminology and grouping people like that as global warming skeptics or climate change deniers, or with regard to Obama, birthers. And then if you can't get a specific term, you say, oh, they're a conspiracy theorist. This is, of course, part of the George Orwell newspeak, that you create a term into which you can put people and then thereby isolate them. I was initially called a global warming skeptic, and then a group of us got together and said, hey, all scientists are skeptics. If you're not a skeptic, you're not a scientist. And so the term global warming skeptic is actually a compliment and not a redundancy. But then starting in about the year 2000, they stopped calling us global warming skeptics and started calling us climate change deniers, because the global warming hypothesis suddenly had a problem. And the problem was that the CO2 kept going up, but the temperature started to level off. And we're going to talk about that when we talk about the pause at the end of this conversation. And this was what Huxley described over 100 years ago as the great tragedy of science, a beautiful hypothesis destroyed by an ugly fact. And they responded to it not by saying, look, our science is wrong. They responded it by moving the goalposts. They stopped calling it global warming and started calling it climate change. And by the way, in those emails that were leaked from East Anglia, there are emails where they are actually caught talking about this, because as you might recall and listeners recall, there were a couple of very cold winters, and people are saying, well, you know, where's the global warming? It almost became a joke. So they realized they had a PR problem on their hands, so they changed the name. But once they changed the name from global warming skeptic, then the climate change people had to have another epithet put against them, so we became climate change deniers, with all of the Holocaust connotations of that term, of course.
Yes, it is absolutely obnoxious. And I do wonder sometimes whether it's backfired to some extent. I mean, I know that it has a rhetorical force and makes people feel uncomfortable. I don't want to be called a denier and associated with what you just said there. But on the other hand, I mean, I find it extremely annoying that anybody should think to use such a term against me when all I am is questioning the situation. How dare you therefore call me a denier? So I'm wondering, has it actually in large measure backfired as a strategy?
Well, it's certainly backfiring, and people don't like name calling. But it also, of course, has emphasized one of the things that's going on in the world, and this has been going on politically as well, in that we're in a world now where if you're not with me, you must be against me.
Yes, the post-George W. Bush world.
Yeah, well, exactly. And but it also is the very antithesis of free speech and free thought and free ideas. And I know we're not talking about my court cases yet.
We'll get there.
We'll get there. Yeah, exactly. We'll get to court sooner or later, yes. So back to the court case.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is Michael Mann, isn't it, has brought this court case against you.
Well,
give us the details as much as you can.
Well, actually, it's more than that, because you see, I've actually had three lawsuits filed against me, all by the same lawyer. That's disturbing in itself. Mm. All three of the lawsuits were brought by this lawyer on behalf of people who were members of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The first one was a lawsuit by Gordon McBean, who chaired the founding meeting of the IPCC in Villach, Austria in 1985. He was an assistant deputy minister at Environment Canada, our National Weather Office. And I wrote an article, and he immediately fired a lawsuit at me. My wife and I sat down and said, no, we can't afford to fight this. So we just withdrew what I wrote. It turned out that worked in my favor, because within a year, I got the second lawsuit from Andrew Weaver. Now, Andrew Weaver is currently the Green Party leader in the province of British Columbia and actually sits in our legislature here. But he was a computer modeler, and he was a lead author on four of the IPCC reports. So he's got a very long history. And I had an interview with him back in 1998 because he'd written an article in the newspaper and I wrote a letter saying, no, you've got problems here. And he called me up to his office at the university. And of course, with all my experience of teaching graduate students and teaching courses, not just the 25 years at university, but also 9 years teaching weather and climate to air crew in the Air Force. And I wrote an article saying that in my professional judgment, he didn't know very much about climate because, I mean, he just simply couldn't answer a lot of the questions I was asking him. And so, of course, he filed a lawsuit against me saying, over 10 years later, he filed the lawsuit saying I was saying it at that time. No, I was saying it in 1998. Now he's learned something since then. But anyway, I got the lawsuit.
How can you bring a lawsuit against somebody for saying that in their professional opinion, you don't know as much as you should?
Yeah, well,
is that what you said?
Yeah, well, that's the issue. Hmm. You've gone right to the hub of the issue here because the lawsuits are classified in North America anyway as what are called SLAPP lawsuits. That's an acronym, S-L-A-P-P. And it stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation.
That's the case with all three of these, is it?
Yes. They're designed to shut you up. Right. Just the fact that you have to go and hire a lawyer and the cost involved is intimidating. Now, the legal profession has become so concerned about what's going on because these lawsuits are the very antithesis of what law should be about. They're silencing people instead of protecting people. And so 32 of the U.S. states have now passed anti-SLAPP legislation.
So this SLAPP, the Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation, this is a way of referring to something that is just a normal lawsuit. So it might be libel, defamation, intellectual property, or whatever the case might be.
Yes.
But the character of it is that the person who's bringing it has no real belief that they're going to succeed with this.
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly. And right. And a court could rule. I mean, you could go to court and the court could rule it's frivolous.
Right.
And it would be thrown out. Now, in the United States, of course, they have the system where attorney generals and public prosecutors look at cases like this and decline to bring them. But unfortunately, they can still be filed directly to a court. So, as I said, these anti-SLAPP legislations are popping up. In Canada, we've got two provinces that allow them. I'll come back to that point in a minute. And so all three of my lawsuits are classified as anti-SLAPP lawsuits. And it truly is disturbing using the law in that way. But the question then becomes, well, why do they go to this extent? Well, they don't care if they lose the suit. That's not the issue. The issue is that I am put into jeopardy financially, emotionally, and everything else. In Canada, they deliver the summons to court on a Friday evening at 4 o'clock. And that's done because you have 48 hours to respond, which, of course, effectively takes the weekend out of play. And it's all part of the nastiness of the use of the law in this way. My wife got to the point where if somebody came to the door at 4 o'clock on Friday, she would not answer the door. She was almost in tears. Nice. That level of intimidation, of course, is frightening.
So the hope, presumably, is then that you will retract whatever it is you've said.
Yes.
Or you've written.
Yes.
And you did in one case, was it, that you said?
Yeah, well, the first case I did. But you see, here's the other thing they do. Now, not all lawyers do this, but in my case, the lawyer did. He filed the suit against me, but he also filed it against the publication that published what I said.
Wow.
And of course, that is a very chilling effect upon free speech, freedom of information, and everything else. And in fact, in the first lawsuit, the company that published what I wrote agreed, without consulting with me, to publish a retraction. And the retraction was written by the lawyer that brought the lawsuit.
Wow.
I mean, it is really frightening. Yeah. What's going on.
And it's not sufficient that the publication in question should issue a disclaimer and say, well, this is the opinion of the writer. It's not our opinion.
No, not our opinion. And this is a huge battle going on because, you see, there have been lawsuits filed now where they're saying, if you publish something, even if you didn't write it, you're legally liable, and you also must try and get taken down across the whole internet what was written. And it's just ridiculous.
It's absolutely chilling. Yeah. Yes. Yes, I can imagine a lot of people thinking, well, you know, I'll think twice before I even talk to so-and-so or publish anything by this particular person. It's something that needs to be resisted wholeheartedly.
17 of the major world news agencies like AP and Reuters and so on have filed what they call amicus curiae, that is friends of the court submissions in America to stop the slap lawsuits and the prosecution of people that publish things. Because, of course, they're out of business effectively if it's approved by the courts. So that's the level at which it's reached. But anyway, I got the lawsuit from Weaver. So we dealt with that. By that point, I went and got a lawyer. And unfortunately, before we got help, we spent all of our savings. And I'm not complaining about that. My wife and I talked about it, and we had pensions. And so we're not suffering in any real financial sense. But the cost is truly inhibiting. But anyway, I then went to Winnipeg in central Canada, gave a public presentation on the hockey stick, what it was, how it was achieved, and how it was not proper science, that they did all sorts of things wrong with it, including claiming that tree rings represent temperature when they primarily represent precipitation. And afterwards, I was interviewed, and the interviewer said, well, what do you think about Michael Mann? And unfortunately, I have that quick English flippancy, as you've probably noticed already. And I flippantly said, well, he's at Penn State, but it appears he should be at State Penn. And within 12 hours, I had another lawsuit by the same lawyer on behalf of Michael Mann. Now, I mentioned earlier that I pulled out of the first lawsuit, and I suspect they thought, don't worry about it, he's pulled the plug before and he'll pull the plug again. Well, at that point, my wife and I said, no, we're not going to be bullied anymore. And we just said, no. I went and got a lawyer and we began the fight. Now, just to show you how corrupt this is, lawsuit was filed in a British Columbia court because that court allows slap lawsuits. And they had legislation to stop them, but the legislature expired and it died on the table, as they say. That court allows slap lawsuits. The suit was filed in a British Columbia court by an American from Pennsylvania about an event that occurred in Manitoba, Canada.
Right, so, get the picture, yeah.
You know, I mean, but anyway, the Weaver lawsuit got set aside. It was the first one. I didn't hear anything on that for almost 6 years. And, of course, this is what Gladstone talked about, that justice delayed is justice denied. And so it's gone on 6 years. The Michael Mann lawsuit sat quietly for 5 years. And then I got notification that I was supposed to be in court on February the 20th of 2017. And I need to explain something here. And this is, again, what people need to think about. In Canada, Britain and American Canada, lawyers and society really need to start to think about all of these things and be aware. But in Canada, I can only defend myself against a defamation lawsuit by saying that what I said was fair comment. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, if I say it's fair comment, I cannot ask for what is called discovery. That is a disclosure of all of the documents and emails and all the other stuff. But the advantage of it is that if I lose, the penalty for losing is relatively small, like, you know, thousands of dollars. But it doesn't really resolve anything if the evidence is in the documents. Okay. If I want to see the documents and get them into the court, and of course, with the hockey stick, what we needed to see was Michael Mann's calculations and what's called the source code.
Yes.
That is, how did he instruct the computer to create the hockey stick? Mm-hmm. And he's consistently refused to give that.
Right. So is this the concessions then that you've asked for and have been accepted by the lawyers?
Well, that's where we are now, but we got to get there first so people understand the sequence. Okay. You see, what Michael Mann has done is refused to disclose how he created the hockey stick. Now, they can reconstruct some of it, but the actual final part, they can't reconstruct. And of course, every one of your listeners has done a math test or exam at some time in their life. And the one instruction you always get is show your work. Mm. When in science, absolutely fundamental to science is what are called reproducible results. In other words, if a scientist makes a claim, he must then disclose how he did it, how he produced it, what his formulas were, and everything else. And then if other scientists can reproduce the same results, then it has validity. Mm-hmm. But because man refused to produce how he did it, and yet the hockey stick became used as the basis of the whole global warming political claim and the introduction of global energy and climate policies, and it's absolutely outrageous.
So this is the information that you've actually demanded now, is that right?
I demanded it, but here's the problem. The Attorney General of Virginia, a fellow by the name of Ken Cuccinelli, he demanded the information from Michael Mann as well. And he said, look, Mr. Mann, you produced this hockey stick. You're not being willing to show us how you did it. Mann then claimed, no, it's my intellectual property. Now, the listeners need to become very familiar with that term, because just to give you an example, one of the reasons that Trump is getting out of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is that 25% of it is devoted to copyright, yes, intellectual property, and all these other things.
What amazes me, though, is if it is in fact the case, as you say, why would he want to hide the information behind intellectual property? Because as a scientist, you know, you've already said something along these lines, he would surely wish people to see the basis upon which he'd reached his conclusions. Why would he do that?
Well, unfortunately, the number of answers are extremely limited to one. He's got something to hide. Because as you said, if he's proud of it, if he thinks it's such a great piece of work, he'd be out there bragging. And by the way, it's 15 years since he did the work. What has he got to hide by keeping it secret now? Mm. But to get back to what Cuccinelli did, the Attorney General of Virginia, he took Michael Mann to court and said, you must disclose this information. And Mann used the intellectual property argument, said, no, this is my personal property. I don't have to disclose it to anybody. And Cuccinelli's argument was, well, hang on a minute, Mr. Mann. The taxpayers paid for your research. So technically, that information belongs to the public. Right. And then not only that, but the results of your science and your research have been used to impact everybody's lives, literally. The whole globe.
It's incredible. You think the whole thing should be so much more simple than this. It's a real sort of spider's web of legalities. I mean, it's extraordinary. And yet the obvious solution is to say, well, look, here's the basis upon which I reached the scientific conclusions I did.
Right.
Just looking at it from the outside you know, it does say to me there is something deeply fishy going on here.
Exactly. And of course, Sir Walter Scott's thing about what a tangled web. But I want to flip back, if I could, for a second here, because about 40 years ago, I was in Bismarck, North Dakota, and the keynote speaker for that conference was the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. And he said, I'm going to tell you what's going to affect the whole world for the next 100 years. And he took a pen out of his pocket and he turned to the person next to him at the head table and said, okay, if I sell you that pen, you have the pen. I no longer have the pen. There is a complete transfer of property. But if I have an idea and I sell you the idea, you have the idea, but I still have the idea. And the challenge going forward in this world of ideas and services is going to be, how do I profit from an idea without having it that every time I sell it, it's automatically devalued? And he said, what you're going to see is an absolute explosion of copyright and intellectual property rights. And of course, that's turned out to be absolutely true. And of course, that's what's at the center of the Michael Mann issue.
Yes, and of course, many people are saying that this issue is being used for covering up all sorts of information, so that if you, I don't know, you produce a video with little clips of something and you're commenting upon it, you know, if things go down that line too far, it would be very easy to say, well, I'm, you know, you've used some of my information, I'm going to clamp down on you immediately.
Yeah.
Forget fair use, you know. Very unfortunate road to go on, indeed.
Well, exactly, but we're on that road, and it's what happens when an economy shifts from a hardware economy into a service economy, an ideas economy.
But of course, it can be abused. Oh. And the point is, you know, the really serious thing is it can be abused. If somebody wants something covered up, then they can plead intellectual property, and there's nothing much you can do about
that's
it.
That's right.
So this is yet another thing that needs to be resisted. So, I mean, the impression I'm getting is that by asking for this background information, you said that there could be a greater penalty upon you for going down that line. Is that right?
Yes.
Are you putting yourself even more on the line by doing this?
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, the final remark by the UN person was, in today's world, Shakespeare would be locked up for plagiarism, which was a wonderful comment. But anyway, yes, I chose to argue that what I said was fair comment, but I also took the other option that the Canadian law allows me and argued that what I said was the truth. If you say what you said was the truth, you can then have discovery. You can force the other person to disclose documents and information. But the downside of it is if you lose, they can not only take everything you own, but they can lock you up and fine you to an unlimited amount, essentially. And so, of course, it's very inhibiting. But I decided, no, we've got literally nothing to lose. And so I chose to argue the truth and force discovery.
Wow.
Well, now, in discovery, man has not produced the information we're seeking.
And he can still plead intellectual property against discovery, can he?
Well, that's the interesting point we're at now, and I don't want to get into legal troubles here by saying the wrong. Well, I'm not afraid to talk about it, but I just want to be accurate.
Yes, yes.
Basically, in a Canadian court, as I understand it, there's a nice legal cover. As I understand it, if you're asked for information under discovery, the intellectual property assigned by a U.S. court does not apply. And it particularly doesn't apply in this case because Michael Mann was the guy that brought the lawsuit. So you really, you think about it, you can't bring a lawsuit against somebody and then deny them the documents that they need to prove that they didn't defame you. Mm. And so this is the situation we're in now. And where we go from here, of course, is going to be interesting to see. But what's happened in the meantime, of course, is they've asked for an adjournment.
Oh, I'm just wondering how long that could be from what you suggested earlier on. You're talking about 5 and 6 year gaps, and presumably you could be looking at that again, could you?
Oh, I'm told that the next possible date for trial is 2019.
Right. Okay.
Right?
So this is really a situation of long-term living with this uncomfortable prospect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Okay, well, I hope that we'll come back to speak to you in 2019.
Yes.
When we've actually find out what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Let's move on then to this Trump era and the EPA. So you were involved in some capacity with the transitional team on the Environmental Protection Agency. You were invited to speak, I understand, to members of that team. How did that come about?
Well, about 30 years ago, I was summoned to appear before the U.S. Congress on the climate issue. And while I was in Washington, I was invited to address a group called the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Some people call it a libertarian group. It really is actually a pro-business, pro-development group. I was invited to speak there, and there was a fellow there by the name of Myron Ebell. And I kept in touch with Myron over the years and saw him at climate conferences. And about a month before the Trump election, he was asked by Trump to chair the transition team for the Environmental Protection Agency and the climate issue. So Myron got a hold of me and a couple of other people, Tony Heller, who also has a website under the name of Steve Goddard. And Tony has been the guy who's showed how they've adjusted the data to emphasize the warming, and they've adjusted all of the global data And the other person involved was Malcolm Roberts in Australia, who'd become a senator, and I mentioned him earlier in the program. Well, we were touring Australia, and Tony would get up and say, here's how they cook the data, and I would then get up and explain how they cook the data. Well, Myron heard about what we were doing because it was on the internet and invited the three of us to Washington to appear on Capitol Hill to a group of senators and congressmen and aides and so on, and then also to appear before the Competitive Enterprise Institute to talk about the transition. Now, the interesting thing for me was I said to Myron, well, how did Trump know a month before the election to appoint you? And he said, the answer is actually quite simple. Trump is a developer, and developers know you don't start planning on the day the building starts. You start planning months before. You've got to have your materials, your people, your financing all ready to go. Otherwise, the building site just becomes chaotic. But anyway, here's the funny part of it. I said to Myron, I said, well, I know you've been following the issue. That's why Trump's asked you. But I said, how prepared were you? And he said, we haven't done very much. And I said, why not? He said, because we thought Hillary was going to get elected. So it kind of backfired him. But anyway.
So you were chosen to, you were invited to do this because of your association with Myron Ebel.
Yes.
So actually, I want to ask you about him and the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Cooler Heads Coalition a little bit later, actually, with respect to a question that I want to bring up.
Sure.
So let me just jump here to what do you actually think the Trump administration intends to do with the EPA?
Well, the direction that we heard from Myron and the Cooler Heads and the transition team was, and Trump has said this publicly, he said, I don't want to get rid of the EPA. We need clean air and clean water. But he said, the problem is you've got the bureaucrats creating policy and creating regulations on their own. One of my favorite quotes these days is Mary McCarthy that said, bureaucracy is the rule of no one. It's the modern form of despotism. You see that in governments throughout the world. It's always been the issue with the classic Margaret Thatcher's favorite TV program, Yes, Minister.
One of my favorite as well, I have to admit. It's wonderful.
Well, but you know, the funny thing about that program is when you watch it the first time, it's funny. When you watch it the second time, it's not so funny. And when you watch it the third time, it's really annoying because you know it's exactly what's going on.
There's a lot of truth in it. Absolutely. That's become even more apparent as the years have gone on, actually.
Exactly.
So with the EPA, then, obviously he's not going to get rid of this. So he wants to cut down the bureaucracy of it. So he wants to reduce the funding and cut the jobs. Now, I read somewhere that Myron Ebel himself has suggested that perhaps 2/3 of the workforce should go at the EPA. Is that right?
Yes. There's two things that Trump is doing. One is, and Myron, of course, has recommended this, and Scott Pruitt, the now appointed director, just simple natural attrition. There are government bureaucrats retiring every day. Just don't replace them. But the other thing that they're going to do, one of the ways that Trump is going to drain the swamp in Washington is to send all of the control of things, or most of the control of things, back to the states. Now, one of the things that the founding fathers did, and I'm a very great student of the U.S. Constitution and the founding fathers and what they did, they thought that the most power and control of people, the largest region that should occur, is the state. Anything beyond the state becomes completely impersonal and people lose control of their lives. And so they had the 10th Amendment. And so what Trump is saying is control of clean air and clean water has to be a regional thing because people in the region know what's best for them and what their problems are. And to have somebody from Washington simply come down and dictate and use it as a way of controlling what you're doing is simply unacceptable. So the combination of natural attrition of people and then simply pulling the funding and turning the legislative control of clean air and clean water back to the states will simply solve their problem.
Okay, well, this brings me then to this issue that I wanted to chat with you about, and I warned you that I would bring it up, because you've mentioned Scott Pruitt there, who's now the EPA head.
Yeah.
And I was reading quite an interesting article, a fairly esoteric article, I will say, but I do think it's an interesting article by the journalist Nafis Ahmed, who's an academic as well. And he has a lot to say about what he believes is the role of the fossil fuel industries with respect to climate skepticism. And he's talking about the Trump administration here. And he mentions Scott Pruitt. He also mentions some other figures here in the Trump cabinet. So he has Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State. And he notes that this chap was former CEO of ExxonMobil. He also points to Mike Catanzaro, who's the Special Assistant for Energy and the Environment. Mm. And Ahmed says, well, you know, he was a lobbyist for the oil and gas industries. And the whole flavor of this article is suggesting that, you know, there's a great deal of influence here from those industries upon Trump's policy with respect to the EPA and global warming, etc. So my question to you is, do you think that Donald Trump himself is at all concerned about climate science in itself? Or is he just essentially interested in promoting American big business interests? You know, whatever the truth or falsity of climate science is, that's basically what he's about.
Well, there's several things that need to be put into the mix here. First of all, Scott Pruitt's from Oklahoma, and Oklahoma, of course, is an oil-producing state. And the senator from Oklahoma, Senator Inhofe, was one of the few that spoke out about the bad science of the global warming issue, the corruption of the IPCC, and so on. Well, I mentioned earlier when I was in Washington and first met Myron Ebell, I also gave a talk at a place called The Monocle, which is a famous restaurant in Washington. And at that talk were several people who later became very much involved in this climate issue. One was Paul Dreesen, who wrote a book called Eco-Imperialism, where he was arguing, I think very justifiably, that North American environmentalists and a lot of European environmentalists were imposing their view of what should be done upon developing nations. And of course, you've seen a pushback from that by people like Prime Minister Modi, who's saying, you're telling me the temperature might go up and you're not very sure about that and your science is lousy. Well, let me tell you something. I got a quarter of my people starving to death. I've got a third of my people that have no electricity. But anyway, Inhofe, of course, suffered because he was from Oklahoma, but his main research assistant was a guy by the name of Mark Morano. And Morano attended that lecture that I gave. And if your audience are interested, they can check his website. It's called Climate Depot.
We did actually speak with him, actually, a couple of years ago. So people will be familiar with him.
Oh, did you? Good. Well, okay. Well, Mark was at the back of the room at that time, and I'd been in contact with him ever since. But here's the issue. If that article that you cited was truly fair and balanced, and of course that's a phrase that Fox News has come up with. I mean, it's for me, it's like when a city says it's world class, that proves it isn't.
Right? I know. Yeah, go on, you finish your point. Go on.
But the news should automatically be fair and balanced. Why do you have to tell people you're fair and balanced? I mean, for me, Fox News is stupid and contrived, because they have the token liberal on there and say, oh, we're fair and balanced. No, you're not. It's rubbish. But this is today's world, unfortunately.
To go back to this main point here, though, I mean, there are different ways of framing it, but let me put it slightly differently then.
Yep.
So people could look at Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, and say, well, look, he is a former CEO of ExxonMobil. Can't deny that. That is, in fact, the case.
Right.
So you could look at that and say, well, Okay, I know that Trump is skeptical towards climate science, but is this really because he's interested in the truth or falsity of the situation? Or is it the fact that he wants to see America great again, etc., and he wants to push American business? Fine, push American business. But part and parcel of that is releasing the energy component of American business and releasing it from the constraints placed upon it by CO2 legislation, etc., that he's just bringing people in who are, you know, skeptical of that whole constraint policy and is doing so just for this economic reason, has no interest in the truth of the situation whatsoever. One could look at that and say, well, this isn't a victory for the truth of climate science. This is just politics going on here.
But that was the whole point I was trying to make. I'm arguing about the article that you quoted. If he's fair and balanced, what he should have done was had a whole section on alternate energies and the crony capitalism and the billions of dollars that went into, you know, alternate fuels and so on under the Obama regime. I mean, Elon Musk's got that Tesla business. Over 80% of his income is government subsidies. How is that any different? You know, I'm not arguing for fossil fuels or so on, but we know that wherever they've tried alternate energies, they've been a complete bust. Look at what's happening in Germany right now, where they're building coal plants as fast as they can because the wind turbines have been a total failure. So that's the first point I would make. So if that guy wrote that article, which attacks companies getting money because of the government policy and therefore the favoritism of the politician, then do it fairly with regard to energy, because you can't just say, well, the fossil fuel industry are corrupting the Trump regime and ignore the fact that the alternate energy companies corrupted the Obama regime. There's got to be some moral equivalency here in what's going on. But let me go further with regard to what Trump is doing. Let's say I'm an investor and I'm looking at places to invest my money, and I go, well, I'm going to invest in energy companies. Well, as long as the subsidies are going to Tesla, my money's backed by the government. That's a pretty good investment. But then when I look at Exxon and I look at the profits they're making and so on and the power they have, hey, that's another good investment. I would not invest in any energy company that was not doing climate research, because your whole industry and its demand is determined by the climate. You go and look at how they switch from producing automobile fuels in the summer to heating fuels in the winter, and how much heating fuels they anticipate based upon global temperatures and all of these things. These are very crucial to that whole energy production sector. So I wouldn't invest, but let's look at the amount of money. ExxonMobil, you mentioned that. We know, because the figures have been released, that they spent approximately $16 million funding climate research. Now, you can check this out on Joanne Nova's research. Compare that with the $70 billion a year that the Obama administration was putting into proving that CO2 was a problem and the global warming was a problem. So you've got that problem. Now,
can I come back to you about that one?
So
that is really very interesting that, as you say, ExxonMobil has actually put money into research, as it were, on the other side, which certainly is interesting. But something that I've heard that, again, I'm asking you to respond to this,
right. But
it could be argued, could it not, that spending in that way, could this not be pure public relations on the part of Big Oil to say, look, we don't just fund the skeptical side with regard to anthropogenic global warming, we fund the other side as well. So look, you see, there's no problem. We're covering ourselves, you know.
And they've done that. Go and look at I look at the David Suzuki Foundation here in Canada, one of the big environmental groups. They get money from Shell and BP and all the others. And British Petroleum, when they were in such bad straits over the Gulf oil spill, were funding all kinds of groups to try and buy some PR, good PR. No, that went on. But by the way, I think that, to me, that's so cynical that it annoys me intensely. Lower your price if you really want to do me a favor. Don't give the money to PR. I could care less. But the final point I want to make here is that unless the public understand what was done with the climate science, how they corrupted it, how they altered the data, the things we talked about earlier, how what they've been told about CO2 is simply false, that CO2 is not the major greenhouse gas by any stretch of the imagination. As you know, it's 4% of the total greenhouse gases. They ignore the major greenhouse gas, water vapor, Why is that not talked about? So once the public understand, and the reason I'm making this argument to Trump and Ebel and all these other people, and I'm going to write a column very soon for the Heartland Climate Conference is coming up in Washington, at which all of these skeptical scientists are going to be present, praising themselves and say, oh, we finally made a breakthrough. Isn't this great? You're just talking amongst yourself. The public still don't understand. And until the public understand, it will be very easy for the Democrats or the environmentalists to come along and say precisely what Julian has just said. Hey, Trump is doing this to put more money in the pockets of his billionaire friends. And you will have no counterargument to that. You have to go on a campaign. And by the way, when I was in Washington appearing on Capitol Hill, there was a conference held at the Heritage Foundation, and I attended that, and people like, oh, Richard Lindzen, Senator Inhofe, and all of them were there congratulating themselves upon the Trump election and how we finally got a new playing field and so on. But there was an oilman and an energy producer by the name of Corbin Robinson Jr. How American can you get?
Lovely.
Okay, out of Houston, Texas. And he said, look, I'm an engineer. I understand the science of the climate issue and how it's been corrupted. And he said, most people don't understand that. But he said, I'm also an energy producer and I understand the dynamics of that. And he said, I'm telling you that what we've got to do now is launch a whole series of PowerPoint presentations across the U.S., to educate the public about what has happened. And that's what I'm working on right now. Because until the public that the science was corrupted to create the problem, that it wasn't the oil companies that were doing it, that doesn't say they're not blameless and that they, you know, play the political game and so on. Right. I'm not absolving anybody in this. All I'm saying is, it is if Trump is going to be successful, because you could argue that within 4 years, Trump loses and the Democrats get back in and bang, they put the whole thing right back in again.
Yeah. So you are saying that big oil, obviously they do play something of a political game. One would expect that. Yeah. So, I mean, I said that I would bring up Myron Ebel and the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I'd bring that up again. Well, let me ask you this as we're on this subject. Hopefully we're closing this little bit of the conversation. So he is heading this Trump transition team, the EPA, and he is the chairman of Cooler Heads Coalition.
Yep.
Now, I understand that is funded by and it's run by the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he is a director of global warming and international environmental policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Okay. Now, I looked at, the Washington Post. Now, I'm not quoting this as necessarily a source of non-fake news all the time, by any means, because that's fake news everywhere these days. They say, in this piece that I read, that the Competitive Enterprise Institute received about $2 million over a period of 7 years from ExxonMobil. This is according to ExxonMobil's then Vice President for Public Affairs, Kenneth Cohen. This is in an interview. So, again, well, you know my position on this, so I'm just being devil's advocate here, but could people not be forgiven for looking at this and being suspicious? You know, oh look, big oil funds skeptical organizations. Money flows from, for example, ExxonMobil to the Competitive Enterprise Institute, then through the Cooler Heads Coalition, and now they're having an influence on the new Trump administration. Might people not be forgiven for being suspicious?
Of course they can be forgiven, because those are the realities. I think that there's that famous quote from Churchill where they said he surrounds himself with yes men. And he said, show me the idiot that would surround himself with no men. You're going to go to the people that are saying the things that you want to hear, that are giving you the evidence that you want to present. We all do that. That's human nature. But the point about people like me, let me go back a bit on this. For example, when I started out, global cooling was the consensus. But I knew there is no consensus in science. And I knew that it was only cooling as part of a trend, that it would turn around and become warming. I was as opposed to cooling as I was to warming later on. And I am now saying to people, hey, we're in a cooling trend and we're going to talk about that with the pause. But one of the things that really annoys me about business is that it's not just business, but hypocrisy abounds in the world. When a business tells you that, oh, we're selling organic food because we care about the health of our customers. Rubbish. You're selling it because you can sell a banana for four times what you'd pay for another banana. And the fact is, if you were losing money on it, you might carry it a little bit with profit from other things for the PR value. But if it was pulling you down, you'd get rid of it. We can debate about what's a reasonable profit. That's a different issue. But this idea of businesses becoming high-minded and green. And in fact, you could make the argument that business world has outgreened the greens at exploiting environmentalism and green. I mean, everywhere you turn around. And in fact, business is cheated in order to appear more green. That's what the whole Volkswagen scandal is about. So, no, I'm not going to defend ethics in business. What I want is them to be open and honest. I don't mind if you sell a product. I don't mind if you make a profit. I don't mind if you charge a little bit more than you should. But don't tell me you're doing it for moral and ethical reasons, which are simply false.
So you are quite happy, and I suppose on the face of it, so am I, that big oil funds particular organizations, and in those organizations there are people who have a particular view on climate science. That in itself seems okay, but is there not a danger that can actually skew the situation, where you might have people who are pursuing a certain tack on climate science just so that they can get the funding? There is a danger with that equation, isn't there?
Okay, well, how is that any different when the oil companies do it than when Tesla does it or when the Greenpeace does it? Yeah. See, this is what's interesting, is that if you get money from Greenpeace or government, somehow it comes without strings attached. Yes. In fact, we know that government money comes with more strings attached. There's more control over what you publish and what you say. And in fact, that's been part of the problem. Right. And I'll give you an example right here in Canada. In Canada, grants for research go to the sciences through the National Science Foundation, which is an agency set up at arm's length to prevent the political interference in research, okay? We then have the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council called SHRC, and it's done for those people doing that kind of research. We have a Medical Research Council that is Science Research Council. But guess what happened with climate research? It was totally controlled, and all of the funding for climate research went through Environment Canada.
Right.
All of it.
Right. Right.
So the bureaucrats were controlling what research was done. And when our Minister of Natural Resources, David Anderson, came out and said, well, we're agreeing to the Kyoto Protocol because we've consulted all the Canadian climate experts and they agree. Eight of us went to Ottawa at our own expense and said, hey, Mr. Minister, here's eight of us and we weren't consulted.
Right.
And guess what he did? He had not announced his policy on climate change at that point. We then said we're going to have a press conference at 10 o'clock on a certain day. He then suddenly announced, oh, at 10 o'clock on that same day, I'm going to announce in the parliament my climate policy. Well, guess where all the media went? It was done deliberately to distract from us. And this idea that money from Greenpeace or Sierra Club or a government is in fact more directed than it is from private industry, because if private industry get caught doing it, there is an accountability in the marketplace that doesn't exist in environmental groups or in government.
So, I mean, the bottom line with this is that the argument from funding with respect to this whole thing is a bit of a red herring, really, isn't it? Because to some extent, it falls into the category of an ad hominem argument. Oh, so-and-so says such-and-such because they're receiving funding from such source, and that doesn't really have anything to do with the argument in question. What we should really be looking at is the argument that's being brought by the person and how cogent that is, irrespective of where they might actually be getting funding from. So I'm beginning to think this is perhaps a red herring, and perhaps that's an important point to stress.
It's more than red, it's scarlet. And not only that, you see, if I'm a scientist and I have an idea and I get funding, let's say I get funding from Exxon, my ideas have to be tested in the scientific community. If they don't hold up, it doesn't matter who funded it. Mm. And by the way, notice how that was controlled as exposed by the leaked emails at East Anglia. What was the one thing they kept pushing. Oh, well, you know, peer review. Oh, he hasn't got any peer reviewed. But what were they doing? They were peer reviewing each other's papers. They were deciding who would be an author on a particular paper in order to fill out their resumes and make their resumes look better. How is that any less corrupt than taking money from Exxon? But that was what was going on. So, as I said, if your science holds up to scrutiny, and by the way, internet has changed everything. I published an article on the internet. Boy, the comments from all over the world, you now got 2 billion eyes seeing it, not just a few eyes in a very specialized discipline reading a very esoteric journal.
Well, true. So ideas are out there for people to scrutinize. I agree. But I suppose one of the things that people would say is that, yeah, but it's not the idea so much. It's the propaganda that's funded by big oil. And then, of course, based upon what you've just said, yeah, but there's propaganda on both sides. So we're back to square one again.
We're back.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
So before we leave this particular issue, I said I was going to ask you. I'm going to ask you again. And that is, are you in receipt of any payments from oil companies?
No.
Have you ever been paid by them to say this kind of stuff?
No, I wish I had. I'm still sitting here waiting for the check. And of course, I could have afforded my legal bills better if I'd received money from the oil companies. No.
I am sensitive to this one because I said to you before the interview, I have actually received, well, it wasn't exactly an accusation, but it was sort of heavily weighted in that kind of direction. It was suggesting that perhaps I was siding with the oil companies. And the question was, well, I'm wondering why you're doing that. Of course, suggesting therefore, presumably I'm receiving some sort of recompense from them. To be honest, I receive nothing from anybody, you know? So there you go. Except for, you know, I've got a few links to Amazon. People might buy some books and I get a few pennies from that. But that is about it. I run this website and podcast at a huge loss.
Well, and of course, it's this whole idea of guilt by association beyond the ad hominem attack. Of course, there's the absolute insult that you're saying, hey, I'd sell my soul for anything. How dare you?
Yes.
How dare you make that assumption of me? Yeah. If you can prove it, fine. Then you can say it. But until then, just shut up.
Yeah.
I was looking for a quote here from Michael Crichton in a 2003 speech. Michael Crichton, who, of course, is the author of Jurassic Park, one of the books that people would find interesting that speaks so much to what we're talking about here is called State of Fear. And what it was about environmentalists and how they work and of how they use fear. The sky is falling, of course, is the traditional thing. But Crichton was a medical doctor by training, and he'd done postdoctoral work at Oxford. And when you reach state of fear, the climate science is surprisingly accurate. And the reason for that is that he shared a room at Harvard with Richard Lindzen. So, of course, Lindzen helped him with the science. But here's the comment that he made in 2003. And if anybody wants to look it up, it's Michael Crichton, Remarks to the Commonwealth Club. He said, I have been asked to talk about what I consider the most important challenge facing mankind. And I have a fundamental answer. The greatest challenge facing mankind is the challenge of distinguishing reality from fantasy, truth from propaganda. Perceiving the truth has always been a challenge to mankind, but in the information age, or as I think of it, the disinformation age, it takes on a special urgency and importance. And I think that that speaks to everything that we've been talking about here in the last little while. What we need to do, and I've been doing this with my grandchildren, I've been giving my projects to them, trying to get them to understand that the internet is an absolute incredible wealth of information, but you have to know what's true and what's not true and be discriminating. And that, of course, that's a word that's politically incorrect these days.
Well, the establishment wishes to discriminate for us.
All right, well, that's
saying,
right.
You don't listen to that. Yeah. That's fake. What we're saying is not fake.
Right.
So, of course, what we have to establish here is whether this hottest year on record is true or fake. And once again, I'm going to have to leave the conversation at that point for this week. Obviously, the interview does carry on for the best part of another hour, I think, so there's a lot more ground that we cover, and we did in fact manage to get through all of the 4 points I mentioned at the beginning of the programme. But once again, I'm afraid I have simply run out of time, and I had the choice of either splitting this program into two or waiting several more days before I can get any of it out. So I've gone for the first option, which I think is okay because it's a rather episodic conversation. It's not a chat about one big topic, which is what I generally do here. So I think it does split into two parts quite well. So I'll try to get around to the second part during the next week, in which we move on to the last year was the hottest on record phenomenon and the whole debate about the pause or hiatus in global warming and the recent controversy over the remarks by Dr. John Bates. So that's for next time. But before I close here today, I have one thing I want to mention. It occurred to me while I was editing this conversation that some people might just possibly mistake some of my questions to Tim Ball as being unnecessarily argumentative, and some of his responses as indicating a certain degree of annoyance at me for asking such questions. Now, I don't suspect that most listeners to this podcast will think that way. As I said before, from the email correspondence I receive, I get the impression that TMR listeners are, by and large, you know, a rather intelligent and discerning bunch, you know, which is not surprising, considering the kinds of subjects I try to cover here and the way that I try to do it, at least. So, you know, I don't think most TMR listeners will misunderstand, but I'm saying this because, well, I have had some messages to that effect over the years, and this seems like a good moment to mention the issue. Rarely, but occasionally, I do get a message that goes something like, well, because I've quoted the BBC or CNN or Fox News or whatever on some issue or other, and I've obviously done that just for the purpose of prompting my guest to respond and bring out their point more effectively. Because I've done that, that means I necessarily agree with the BBC or CNN or whatever. I've quoted them as an authority against my guest. And then when my guest responds with some agitation in their voice, that must mean that they're exasperated with me, not that they're exasperated with the source that I'm quoting. Now, again, I don't think most TMR listeners are going to make that elementary mistake, because I'm quite sure that 99% of you out there are fully familiar with how proper interviews work. It involves some degree of playing devil's advocate. We understand that. But, as I say, there's always one, so for that 1% or 0.1% or whatever, let me take this opportunity to say, so that I do not have to answer another email based on this misunderstanding. If you happen to be listening and you think that some of my questions to Dr. Ball show that I'm somehow against him, that his momentary agitation is evidence that he's simply impatient with me for my ignorance and stupidity, then just to prove to you that he was not the least bit upset with me for asking such questions, but actually he understood what I was doing completely, let me end the program by playing to you a part of our chat after the interview that covered precisely this point. So, in the hope that I shall not receive any communications to that effect, let me turn to the 100%, or that proportion of the 100% of TMR listeners that just happen to be listening to this particular show today, and say thank you for listening, and as always, for your moral support. The next part will come out as soon as I can manage it. And finally, you have been listening to me, Julian Charles, of themindrenewed.com, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the very near future. Thank you for putting up with those questions that I said I'd...
No.
But I just felt that there was a certain point when I felt I needed to do that, because I did get a number of emails coming my way, you know, asking those sorts of questions, and part of the role of an interviewer is that you try to ask the questions that people would ask if they were sitting in the same seat. So, yeah, I hope you understand that.
Oh, yeah. Totally understand it. In fact, one of the problems I have is I tend to witter on too long and people can't break in, but I'm glad you did, because otherwise it becomes a monologue. And this has really got to be a dialogue. It may be a little uneven because I'm the guest, but absolutely, beyond that, no.
That's one of the benefits, isn't it, of your coming back on the show several times, exactly, is that we get to know each other, and if we understand that we're, you know, not being insulting, that's part of the dynamics of the interview. So that's
great. The other thing, by the way, about my lawsuits and all of the rest of that, as I've said many times, I knew when you stand up in the coconut shy, they're going to throw at you. And if you're not prepared for that, don't stand up.